Yes. Well, basically, I had a discussion with Doug and Leon and a couple people this morning, and I talked about something somewhat quite different on this issue, which has been a long-standing problem of how a quasi-particle is born when you dope the Mach insulator. Okay, and Leon felt that was a topic much closer to this, so I basically want to talk about that instead. Now, let me just say that it was an issue has been in the field for a long time. What happened when you dope an insulator? If you dope an ordinary semiconductor or ordinary band insulator, I have a band structure. Here's my energy, and here my density of state. I have a situation. I have a energy gap. That is a situation. Then you will say, if I dope it with a p-type doping, maybe I'll say n-type doping first, then what I have should have been a situation that my chemical potential EF is here. That will be the n-type. And if I would dope with a p-type, my chemical potential should have been here. Right. In other words, if you dope this problem from p to n, you should have seen the chemical potential have jumped across the gap. That's the case for ordinary insulators or semiconductors. Now for the, what happened, what about a Mach insulator? That was the question. In 1988, Jim Allen in a PIL, he said, when I dope, compare with the electron-doped and the hole-doped cuprates, okay, I do not see this jump across the Fermi level. Okay. Instead, they seem to be always sit at a very similar position. Okay. And this is very peculiar. Although we do not feel we have the same level of understanding of a band insulator or semiconductor, but the general feeling is that a many-body model, such as the Hubble model, give you a gap. When you dope this system, almost all cases, you see a spectral weight dynamics, but you should always see the chemical potential across the gap when you dope in this system. This was a rather peculiar result. And historically, I think it's fair to say this was one of the experiments that motivates Steve Kiverson and Vic Emery to say there's a phase separation. In a phase separation situation, then the chemical potential was pinged inside. And was not satisfactory for many of us. And this is because chemical potential is such an important thermodynamic property. And we do not understand it's one of the most fundamental properties. Okay, and you see a lot of photometric data and many things present to you, but this really important problem being swept under the rug in many ways. Okay, and later on, George Zavatsky's group, my group, and begin to show data that shows chemical potential moves around. Okay, we say there are chemical potential moving. But as you will see that they move in a very irrational way. Okay. And that is another puzzle to do this. And recently, my student Carl Shen has made progress on this problem, and we felt that we understood this problem, and actually is very closely related with what's going on in this workshop, and I want to talk about. In other words, how you're going to give birth to a quasi-particle when you dope a Mott insulator. Because a quasi-particle got to have where it sits. That's where the chemical potential is. Okay. I have a basically this to my collaborators. I want to emphasize that now I've changed the talk. I haven't changed this slide. The Kyle Shen made a lot of contribution to this, and I collaborated with Fujimori's group at Tokyo, Zahi Hussain's group at Berkeley. Then I may have time to talk about some of the work I did with Nagosa and Tom Devereaux. The contribution of Nagosa for this particular case was that it motivated us to rethink this problem. Now let me go through, for this audience, is there such a thing? Okay, good. That's probably good enough. Okay, for this audience, you probably hear a lot, and you have photon comes in, take the electron out, and you energy analyze the electrons, and you get basically the dispersion relationship. Okay, and you know the energy and the momentum of the electrons in outer space, then you're using conserving laws of energy and momentum, get information on energy and momentum inside. The progress over the last 4 or 5 years is the improvement of the angular resolution. Okay. That turns out to be very important. And for example, now you can see that as I take, that's a traditional stack of the spectra taken a different angle, and basically to say that I have a band dispersion. Okay, that's the cartoon view. And for this audience, you know we are measuring spectral function weighted by the Fermi function and the matrix element effect. And this, I always felt was one of the trying for angular resolutions. There were a lot of, because the bismuth cuprates, you have two copper oxygen planes. There always idea whether because you have two copper oxygen planes, then because of the interaction, you should see a Fermi surface spreading. And this Fermi surface indeed split into two pieces, as you can see over there. Okay. So those are this introduction to the technique. Then you can also measure the energy gap. And in the this is the things you will measure in the early days. Now you can take a lot more angular points. Again, it's the angular resolution. Okay, now I want to show you results from two systems. One is the system, the Langston-Strunsen copper oxide system. The other is a system called calcium copper oxychloride. I don't know if you have a Seamus Davis lately or not. That's the system where he sees a very nice charge ordering pattern on this. So these are the two systems. The reason going into this is because we want to look at underdoped, deeply underdoped system. In those systems, that the traditional material like a BISCO is not very good. For materials property, BISCO like to be grown at optimum doping. When you force them to be very underdoped, the quality goes down. Well, in those two materials, zero doping is the best quality, and the material quality decreases as increase. Okay, that's okay. Another thing, which is the LSCO, which you cannot do with BISCO, is that you can go through the entire doping range, and that's something again you cannot do. Okay. But there are very steep learning curves. For example, in early days, we felt that we could not, you can see that the features were very broad and weak, okay, in this case. But later on, we learn, go through that, and how to optimize experiment. I would say this classical example of persistence. After 2 years, we don't get too much of good results. We're almost giving up. Then you begin to see signals. Once you see signals, then you know how to optimize it. Okay, when you only have noise, it's extremely difficult to optimize. Okay, this is what I always tell Seamus. He said, ZX, tell me how you prepare the LSEO, you know. I said, look, come to send a student over, and we'll show you exactly what we did. And I said, just with patience, 1 or 2 years, when you're persistent enough, you'll get there. Which is true, I mean, you know, it's... I think that the real magic bullet is that the sample guys gets much better, I would say. I think it's a fair statement about that. I think, I mean, if I look the samples from the same group, okay, and with time improves, I'm normally the same doping. And here is what you see. Here I have a zero doping. You can see it's an insulator, completely broad spectra. Here's the Fermi level, no spectral weight at the Fermi level. Okay. When you dope the system at 3%, you begin to see something here. Okay. You depend on your taste, you call it a quasi-particle or something. But it's something reminiscent of a quasi-particle wanted to be born. Okay. And of course, this is the central intellectual issue. What happens with this guy's ball? Now I want you to bear this in mind of this issue because they are intimately related. And when you come to the 15% doping, you can see very nice peak. I want to say that in the entire underdoped regime, if you literally look at the nodal direction, the LSCO, in every level, the data quality rivals that of BISCO. When I say that, as I'm saying that as a spectroscopist, what I mean better data means at the same doping and the same condition spectra looks sharper. Okay.
A short question. Is there now a reasonable understanding of the background which is seeing those pictures here?
That's the million-dollar question we will try to understand exactly this. What did they want to ask? What is the origin of this broad thing? Okay, and I will argue to you that what is really interesting is that even at a 1% doping, depending on your taste, okay, there's embryo of quasi-particle want to be born, even at a 1%, okay, doping. And that's, now if you do that as a function of doping, you can see the quasi-particle weight increases with doping. Okay, and that's the red and blue curve are different way of measuring the photo emission data. The red dot is the whole number, and if you plot the super free density, you know, they are monotonically increases too. Okay. I do not want to claim that to be real yet. It could be, but. Probably more needs to be done. Okay, now let me show you something about the dynamics of the system. Here's a sample sort of near so-called the superconductor, non-superconductor transition. There's this so-called spin glass phase, okay, like this.
The green arrow is where the data was shown.
The green arrow is the data I'm going to show the doping range. Okay. Here's the results. That's the typical raw image of the data come from the detector. Okay. And that's what you have as a dispersion. This is about a slightly over 6% doping. And you can see that you see a really sharp peak. Okay. You never can dream of this kind of spectra from the underdoped BISCO. Okay. I think Mohit would attest to that. Okay. I want to stress to you the progress being made. Here we use, instead of a typical K, we're using an experimental value called angle. In the early days, when we do experiment, we have 4-degree angular resolution, plus minus 4. And you can see that this band dispersion and this kink, which caused a lot of debate, and okay, you will wash everything out if you integrate. One of the things that those nodal quasi-particles have a lot of dispersion. Okay, if I have a band this steep, small delta K just translates a very large delta E. Okay. So that is the thing. And
this is the normal state?
This is the normal state because this thing is not...
It's
never superconducting. Yeah. Okay. So. We know this is consistent with the transport data with a very high mobility of this system. And in many ways, now we can, since we can have this kind of data, we can do an analysis, we can do the Fermi surface analysis. The way we do it is plot the spectral intensity at zero frequency, okay, and then make a momentum space cuts and determine where these peak positions are. Because those features are very sharp in momentum space, so you can determine this red spot very well. Okay. And this data is over-constrained. And another thing is that you can see a very strong matrix element effect. Those things were very clearly seen here and weakly seen here. Okay. However, even with those cuts, that's this cut, I think it's still reasonable to say that you can determine the peak position pretty well. Okay?
Pressure should be a
pseudo gap, right? LSCO, the pseudo gap is always very small, right?
Oh, okay.
Remember that. Yes, there's a pseudo gap, but it's a much smaller size pseudo gap. Okay. And we've been diligent, and those are Fermi surfaces of a different system, and it's roughly consistent with LS, with what you would expect it. And you have an electron hole-like Fermi surface, and it crosses over to an electron-like Fermi surface near optimum doping, close to optimum doping, when the Van't Hoff singularity moves. Okay. Now let's look at this in more detail. As I said, I can now have data from five different Brian zones, and lay on top of them. That's why there's some scatter in the data. Okay. But that gives you a pretty close constraint in the data. And that's what the Fermi surface look like in this system. Now.
Wait, just a question on that?
Yeah.
I mean, you have these two flat regions on the right hand plot.
Yeah. That's pi pi.
No, I know, but if you go out.
See, you have flat.
Expanding wave vector.
Yeah, you have a vector here.
Yeah, what is that?
And it's a vector. I think it's 0.78 pi, 0.78 pi, or 0.8 pi. It's not pi pi. So, okay. Now I want to show you. Now I want to show you the results. You can see. What is interesting is that I have showed you earlier. I said if I were to make a cut like here, I see very nice peak. I see very nice peak. Then if I make a cut here, I see another nice peak. And those peaks are more or less a resolution limited peak, okay? But then this peak, at some point, this sharp peak diminishes. Okay, that's when I'm making cuts here. Those peaks, you no longer see them. And this is sort of a blown up view of a cut here. You can see that this peak sort of persists up to about 70 millivolt. Then after that, it turns into an edge. Okay, so it survives a certain energy range. Again, here, depending on your taste, you can say, well, this peak is still too broad to be called a quasi-particle and all that, but we're using this as a language. Okay. Basically, you can, and that coincides with, a sudden break in the dispersion relationship, and that is a subject I may or may not have time to talk about. It's a separate subject. Okay, and of course, in our view is that that's due to the coupling to a phonon. Okay. Now I want to come back to this and say, what is interesting is that you see in this section of the Fermi surface, you see a nice peak, but it's a pretty suddenly. As the Fermi surface turn around, you don't see this sharp peak anymore. Okay? So here I'm sort of make a mark. I see nice sharp peak here, but I don't see any really sharp structure once the Fermi surface turn around. Okay. This is somewhat peculiar, right? The reason it is peculiar is that here I'm plotting this, and this is the momentum going around the Fermi surface near the node. Okay. I said in this region I can see a quasi-particle peak persist up to about 70 millivolts. It's reasonably sharp. When I go away from that, okay, the pseudo gap is about 10-15 millivolts in LSCO system. Even as I get to an edge, I don't see a sharp structure. Right. Therefore, we suspect there's an additional, that of course there's a scattering mechanism. Then this, you have to say that there's got to be some additional scattering mechanism to broaden it, okay? To broaden this process. Of course, this is not, in some senses, not surprising, okay? Not surprising because you can argue, well, as you go to the antinode, you're no longer at the zero energy excitation because you're at finite energy. Right? Of course, you should see a broadening. But what is peculiar about it is that cannot be the only argument, because at the node, I get even higher energy, still pretty sharp. In antinode, you only go up to 15 millivolt, you already have a lot of broadening. Okay, so that was the reason we felt, okay, now, the doping dependence. This behavior is there at 6%, 9%, you can see that. But once you go over-doped, then this broadening near the antinode, of course the Fermi surface changes, near the antinode is no longer there, and the peak near antinode is actually sharper than the peak near the node. Oh, those are very similar, okay? I just want to say this is one should not read too much about this being sharper than that here, just because the antinode, the contribution from the momentum resolution is much less because the bands are flatter. Okay, so this is actually an indirect indication that it's happening. Okay, so at the moment, there are two possible interpretations. One is, of course, we know there's incommensurate spin fluctuation in this system, which will give me the hot spot in this red region, so you can broaden it. Okay. The other, which we think probably is important, are the scatterings across here. Okay. When you have parallel Fermi surface just like that, you're going to have scatterings across here, we think is important. So it's telling you that there's a very rich and interesting dynamics.
Okay.
Now,
looking at the data, there seems to be a lot of notes like scale and momentum, beyond which we keep circling this. Is the scale, does it have a noticeable doping thing? Like it seems to be able to stay and shrink when it goes to lower doses, particularly in the length of the bars.
Yeah. Of course, you know that the higher energy scale around the 70 millivolt does not change much with doping throughout. That was one of our reasons to believe it was the lattice. Okay. The antinode broadening, that I think there's additional broadening mechanism, that is a thing which I show you data does evolves with doping. Okay, that's a process that's more there in underdoped and less in this overdoped system.
Well, there's an inconsistency with the XDM verse, right? Which is sort of suggesting that it changes going on between coherent engineer nodes and antinodes, somehow on a much grander scale, right? It's still the same statements that these double fermions are always the same thing, always very coherent, and then they get an antinode, you start to see all these inhomogeneities, etc. Meaning that there's complete change of physics going on there.
Right. Okay. Phenomenologically, that's correct.
Yeah,
that's and that's consistent with what we see. Okay. I think what does that mean? You could have a different interpretation. You're right. There's the two sides of the same story. Okay. Now I want to. This is another thing is that, which the I think the interesting is basically to say that, it's more or less a situation that the velocity is, okay, by the way, let me back off. What I show you are the dispersion at different doping, okay? What I show you is the dispersion at different doping. And the slope of each of the dispersion tell you the velocity of the quasi-particles, okay? And of course, the slope changes a little bit, but not change very much as you go towards the Mott insulator state. And this, of course, is a very interesting result. Because as you go towards, usually the one way you can think about I go into insulator is that I'm making the mass go into infinity. But this is the case to say that those Mott insulator, when you go under doping, the mass does not go up. Okay, it's more or less the same. And that's very consistent with the story from optics, okay, and even the number, the electron mass we get about 2, and then the optics get to 3, and then the mobility doesn't change, okay. Remember Yoichi Ando's work to say that the mobility of the system doesn't change much as you go underdoping. And these are all really remarkable, okay, and so that's consistent with that. I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, now I want to talk about different material system. Which I want to tie what I showed you so far from LSCO, okay, to this problem of the sodium doped calcium cup oxychloride. Okay. And this is a system that has a relatively low TC, but it's not that low compared with LSCO. The optimum is about 39, the optimum is 29. It has the same crystal structure as a Langston strontium copper oxide system. And that's the material grown by Hide Takagi's group. And we got to do angle-resolved photomation and Seamus Davis's group, in collaboration with Hide's group, do the STM, and they see this beautiful ordering pattern. Okay. This has the same advantage as the LSCO when you study low doping, because the material start out to be the best. Okay. This is just some of the material properties. You know, it doesn't have these other things which are problematic for the other compound. And let me come back to this issue. You know, once undoped, you should see a chemical potential anywhere inside the gap. That's the density. That's the field, the lower Hubbard band. That's unhappened. And once you dope a p-type, it should be here. And this does not seem to be straightforwardly seen. So there are ideas that maybe we are creating states inside the gap, and that is some of the earlier motivation to say that maybe that's what will happen if you have phase separation. Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now let me talk about this. To appreciate that, maybe the first thing to do is just to study the insulator. And here's some of the data we have from the insulator. I think they were used, probably the connection was not very good. The theoretical prediction from the calculations like that, and this is the experimental results. Okay. Of course, several things. Okay. The band is much narrower, but most importantly, I want to bring your attention to that the bands reach a maximum at half pi rather than pi pi. Okay. This is a clear indication of some sort of symmetry breaking. But now if you think about that, because the half of pi is where the anti-ferromagnetic zone boundary hits. Okay. This problem has been studied a lot by numerics, and you can fit this work with the TJ model explanation very well when you fiddled with T prime and T double prime. So it's a sort of the under. So we do have a situation where the magnetic or the Hubble-like Hamiltonian seem to give a good sense of that. However, the chemical potential issue remains. Okay. What I mean now, the advantage now is that we were able to have this in this material, some of the very nice chemical markers stay. The state which are relevant for our discussion have very small signal are those guys here. Okay? In this scale, you don't see them. But we have these so-called non-bonding oxygen states. They can be used as a marker. And these are the two, a pair of the non-bonding oxygen states in different part of the momentum space. Therefore, I can do that as a function of doping. You can see that as I change the doping, I see this guy shifts in the same way. But the shape does not change much. You see the overall thing shift, and that's what you would expect it. From that, you can get a chemical potential shift at 4% this, and it's about a 400 millivolt shift. Okay. So indeed, you do see a chemical potential shift. Okay. But this chemical potential shift is not a trivial shift. Okay. Let me show you this. I have a spectra. I've told you so far, okay, I have a band doing this, okay, and I can explain this dispersion with one of our favorite theoretical models, okay, and therefore, according to that scenario, this will be my quasi-particle, right? That's the band dispersion, and this peak broadening is just some lifetime broadening or some material properties. Okay, and in the insulator, of course, my chemical potential can be pinned anywhere in the gap. Depends on the defect and the surface I created. Okay. So nothing special about it, right? What would you expect? Well, if this is the top of the band, as soon as I doped, I would have moved things to here. I think it's probably fair to say almost all theoretical models will predict that in a sort of a homogeneous system will do that, like dual Hubbard and all. There are variations of the spectral wave, but this shift is there. Okay. Now let's look at the data. See, now I see my chemical potential being moved to here. Okay. Interestingly, I begin to see notice that I don't have any weight, I just have a sloping weight coming in here. Okay. Now once I move down, my chemical potential moved here and I begin to build up an edge, almost like a Fermi edge thing, but not quite. This is 5% doping. Okay? But I did not move this to where I wanted it to move. Right? In other words, let me draw to the corner. I have a band like this, and my original chemical potential is here. I would have expected this guy to move here. Instead, it moves, but moves to here. Okay. I will now show you data. It moves to here and moves to here. In other words, it moves significantly and by significant amount, but it is in wrong place. Let's see it move more. Yes, that's why I said it's the edge, begin to build, right here. Yeah, I see it begin to build, but now you begin to see the quasi-R particles begin to be born. Okay, and you see a sharp structure, but still haven't get to where I wanted it to be. Okay, furthermore, now I, you know, depend on your taste, whether you call this quasi-particle or not, but something like a peak, right? Okay, and this, okay. Recall earlier I showed you the LSCO data. In LSCO, I think that because the charge ordering was is weaker relative to this system, therefore the quasi-particle is showing up much earlier, but the qualitative picture is the same. You begin to build up the weight, okay?
I thought earlier on you consider the little quasi particles. Those green arrows would be the location of chemical potential. And then now, if you consider the quasi particles, where is the chemical potential? How do you define it?
Yeah. Okay. Let me. When I have an insulator, chemical potential is ill-defined anywhere inside the gap. But once I dope as a metal, my chemical potential can be independently measured by grounding the sample to a reference, which is gold. Therefore, in this case, this line was determined by the reference. Okay. Now I see this guy shift, and they see this guy shift, and that's the data. Right. Okay. That's where. You would be, see that. And then let's look at what happened. Once you dope it, what I do now is that, okay, here's my insulator, I have my have a band, I have my chemical potential pinned inside the gap, no problem. All of us are happy, this the situation. Yeah, I'm gonna come back to that. Yeah, that's part of the story, as you probably know that. Okay. Now I have a situation like this. Then I said I'm doping to this. On the one hand, I'm rather happy I did refined experiment. Refined experiment allow you to see a chemical potential jump, but it doesn't jump to where I wanted it to be. It jumped in the middle. But you can also see that what I did here is try to use so-called MDC analysis, the momentum distribution analysis. Basically, you can make momentum space cut and try to get the dispersion only for the low energy excitations. Okay, and that's what happened. What happened when you dope more? Fermi level drops more, and this guy goes further. Okay. And this blue corresponding to this guy, this low line excitation of this guy. Okay. What happened more? This green corresponding to this guy. You can see that. They appear to just follow what you would expect. Okay. By the way, by the amount, nodes are different from the band structure. And you have a KF shift tracking each other. Okay. So I think by now this should have been clear that what is crying out to us was that we should not have thought about this guy as a quasi-particle. We should think about the quasi-particle in low doping has a very low weight. They were here. Okay. Then it will make sense. Okay. What did I have? Okay. Motivated by this startling inconsistency, on the one hand you see them moving as you would expect it. On the other hand, you see them moving in the wrong place inside the Mott gap. Then we have to go back and re-exam, as Muhib pointed out, even in the insulator, looks rather broad. Remember we were rather happy this dispersion looks like the TJ model or the Hubble model. Well, indeed, you can fit this very well, pretty well, okay? But this spectra is very broad, okay? Even in the insulator. Even at this point, it's very broad, okay? Even at this point, I believe all calculations show this should have been sharp at that point. There are one or two exceptions, but I think most of them. That, of course, is another red flag. Okay. Just to say.
Am I supposed to think of that there's any significance to the energy of half an electron volt?
Yes, of course.
Am I allowed to use that to compute a gap?
Yeah, I think you may say that. I'm not sure computing gap, we have to think about the gap. Rethink about some of the gap thing because we will identify the wrong thing.
Well, okay, but if I change my identification.
Yeah. Well, you have to redefine the gap in that sense. But since I never know what's the other side of the gap, gap was not something, this particular experiment is very good at measuring.
Since you don't really know where the
other side, right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the chemical potential doesn't have to be in the middle of the band.
Okay.
It's pinned by something.
So, well, we were happily to say that this guy is moving like that. Okay. Except the very broad. You can always say, well, it's a quasi-particle. You can still think about it as a quasi-particle, but just with very long width, short lifetime. What's wrong with that? Okay. Well, we already know if you do that, you have held a difficult time to understand the chemical potential, which was very important quantity. The other thing is that if that's a quasi-particle, usually think about broadening. You should have fitted it very well with the Lorentzian, okay? The line shape doesn't look like a Lorentzian, rather almost like an exponential. So we say, okay, let's take a different view of that. Instead of calling that a quasi-particle, maybe let's phenomenologically pin down the two quantities. One is the quantity of this peak we like and love. The other is the onset of signal. Okay? I have onset of signal. The onset of signal can be defined, let's say, by 3 sigma, sigma being the noise level. Okay? If you are 3 sigma away, you say, oh, I begin to have onset of signal. And what happens? Oh, by the way, this is just to show macho-ness. You have when you really have a quasi-particle like strength and loosening, that's what you see. Okay. So that's a quite different. Okay. Okay. Now I'm plotting. This A is the thing we wanted. And this B is the onset, which is defined by 3 sigma. It's here, that's the B, okay? That's what it is, okay? So this solves another puzzle. Okay, maybe I should back off a little bit. Back off a little bit. If this is my quasi-particle, at this point is the top of the band I'm looking at. Okay? What this means is that in an insulator, depends on the circumstances of the surface defect I created by cleaving it. Okay? I should have my chemical potential pinged anywhere randomly. Right? That's what, you know, depends on the circumstances. What experimentally we find is that there's always a bound in the data. The chemical potential always sits above that. It never gets to this range. So I show you B, then I show, you know, those horizontal lines are all come from different measurements. Okay? Indeed, they were randomly distributed. It depends on the details of different measurements and the different here. Okay? But what is striking about it is that it never go below this line in the insulator. Where? Defined was, you see, I have a floor level of background. B was defined by 3 sigma deviation from the noise level of the background. Okay? Just a basic onset of the signal. Yes?
Are there any known insulators or that kind of band insulators which have ever shown sharp quasi-particles? Any insulator?
I would say the answer is for Mach insulators, definitely not. For band insulator, I am not as familiar with some of the semiconductor literature.
I guess in silicon,
it's
pretty sharp.
No, not at this level. I mean, in semiconductor work, mostly done with relatively poor resolution. Okay, well, poor result. So, Matthew, I'm not sure I can give you a definitive answer. Okay, so phenomenologically, how one should think about it, here's the way we are beginning to think about it is that this is the photoemission spectra from hydrogen spectrum. Okay, that's a hydrogen atom. And that you can see that instead of one peak, you see all those peaks. Of course, in this particular case, we will call this the quasi-particle and the rest are the incoherent. Okay, just in this case, you have a quasi-particle with a Z is about 10%. The spectral wave goes to the rest of that. And in this case, it's a classical case, it's the Frank Condon effect. Okay, so one way we can reconcile all those puzzles is to say that we have a situation with a very small z at a low doping, and as you increase doping, the z increases. Okay, this was what Kyle put together. Let's see. Yeah, I think. This is the part I wasn't put them together. But I think, I think the data, let me just go back to this. This is consistent with what I showed you early on at the LSEO. It's just in LSEO, I think it's more dramatic even. Now, looking back, this again is the same incoherent thing with a very low weight. Okay, once you dope them, you begin to bond something bond and increase doping and increase. And these two systems really look very, very consistent with each other.
But there was at least some shift in the chemical.
Yeah, what I want to say was the following. Atsushi and I, he was referring to, in the case of LSEO, my collaborator, Atsushi Fujimori, who said that there was a very, basically, no chemical potential shift. I've emphasized in the strontium copper oxychloride, this experiment was done in the same valence band, where the feature is extremely sharp. So you can track that with the kind of precision you wanted. I think we are going to go back and relook at some of the LSEO thing. Remember, the chemical potential in LSEO was looked by core levels, which are 900 volt below, right? That's the copper level, that which are 900 low. You know, we're looking at the tenth floor basement measurements. Okay, and it's not the same level. Okay, within the error bars, not necessarily inconsistent. We need to really look at that. But I think the physical picture of how the quasi-particle was born. It's basically, in this case, a very low Z. And once you dope it, you begin to see Z increases, and as much of this coherent thing was still there, eventually this guy grow at the expense of this incoherent wave. Okay.
Efficiency.
Yeah.
I actually have to refer to a previous picture. Where this PP, it appears to me that the pulsing is pretty dispersionless, meaning that in the 60s wave, conventional wave, there are very small pulsing goes hand in hand with big mass.
Yeah.
And now it alludes to the fact that, you know, at the moment you start to see mass particles in the stream mass is very low, not from the solid.
Yeah, let's see. You are talking about.
So A is sort of a very dispersion, and then B, when I think about it, it's a small.
Yeah. Okay. I think in the LSCO, of course, this little peak is easier to see, but qualitatively it's very similar, these two pictures. Like, whether this guy has a dispersion or not, because remember, the definition with the three sigma, it's a tricky question. I'm not sure I wanted to go into it. Okay. But I think now the picture, at least for me, for the first time, I'm beginning to be happy. I felt I have an understanding to this question we always wanted to look at. What happened when you dope the mod insulator? Okay, now let me.
They were basically referring to a rather classic follow-on picture, right? Which I think makes a lot of sense. Because in order to get a spectral wave so far down, you need strong retardation. You need really a big mass scale to suggest that these electrons are the right to happen. That really means that at the same time, these quasi particles have to become very massive, very heavy, right? And at the same time, the recuperation now is so outstanding
I don't feel I was paid to try to understand them. I'm mostly paid to measure them. Now, so it really is, you know, you guys are paid to do that, and it's the burden's on you now. I don't want to dodge the issue, but I think that the experimental phenomenology is very striking and pretty clear. Okay. Let me try to say that just to make it fair, I think I'm aware of a couple models which will do that. One of them, in one way you can think about it within the context of the TJ model, and somehow the coupling of the quasi-particle, to the spin waves broaden the spectrum. I think that is not a majority of the TJ model calculating. This claim exists in the literature. Okay, I think, but most of the calculation said the quasi-particle at this point is a sharp thing. It's not Z. Almost close to zero situation. Okay,
yeah,
so.
The calculation showing that the quasi particle is quite out there and.
I don't know. No, I'm just saying those were the things I'm not trying to. Okay. But the issue is that for those calculations, of course, the issue of dispersion has not been addressed. And the second class of theory, I have told you again and again, this broad hump, now we know it's the incoherent part, still somehow tracks the TJ model very, very well. Okay? Now, what you wanted to do is you want to fix this width problem and the chemical potential problem, but you don't want to screw up the good part. I mean, the TJ model certainly does something which catches aspect of the data. Okay? And I think this recent work on the TJ prolon problem does have that feature. Like, it basically, it is, I don't know, it's on the ComMed a couple, I think 2 weeks ago. Okay, that's by Mishchenko and Nagosa. Okay, what they say was that what will happen if I take the TJ model and let it couple to the lattice? What will happen? And I think I was trying to get onto the ComMed and try to get it. So I managed to pick one, and just to say that that's the sort of thing, right? That's basically when you have a when you have this thing, what you have is really this quasi-particle with a very small z, and this guy does not show much of dispersion. But what was surprising was that this incoherent part. Now there are two incoherent parts in this model. Those are the incoherent part of the TJ itself, that's of course, okay. But then you have this incoherent part, and they seem to show dispersion. It turns out that, okay, this dispersion, when you included that,
where's the
full
model in this picture?
Well, okay. I think in this picture, I think basically to say that I have the TJ model and a couple to this, and these are some of the incoherent weight. And now the question is that, will the incoherent weight show a dispersion which are similar to the original band without the phonon being considered, indeed they were tracking the original case, okay. Now the question, of course, whether this is unique or not, okay, whether this is unique or not, but I think it's an interesting. I agree with you completely, it's a rather generic in the prolon theory. But what I'm trying to say is that I want to give credit to people who have said in this specific context. And I'm not wed to it and all that. That's what. I mean, this certainly was a piece of work, have some stimulation of, in the discussion. Okay. Then there were other issues. So I think if you guys are not bored, I want to talk about one more somewhat different topic. If you are bored, then I can quit here. So that's what it is. So, yeah. So boss, as I said, I can go on to talk about a little bit about next topic, or we can discuss this, and I think I'm quite excited about it because I felt this was a problem that being swept under the rug, the chemical potential problem, and I felt that, in particular, this work by Carl, in particular, when you see them behave in this way, so consistently tracking down, and even those parts seem to connect well. And now this consistency with the LSCO, I think this is, in my own view, that it's something I feel that it was. Now you can see why those things are all doing it inside the gap and all that. So I can continue to talk about a little bit of a topic, or we can quit here. So that's all.
We have time to, you know, talk a little more.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll be happy to.
I mean, is there any problem with charge buildup on the
Sample?
On the sample and things like that.
Yeah.
Temperature? You're at room temperature. Or
Well, of course, the insulator was measured at about 150K. All the metals are measured at low temperature. Those are metals. Okay. I mean, they are even superconductors. There is one thing which is an independent check. If this will be, you see, my chemical potential here, as I said, was calibrated with something different, right? With an independent calibrator. Yet I see a Fermi step. They're coincident. If there's a charge build up, this step will be different from where the chemical potential is. Okay. And I have two material systems work similar. LSCO actually, even at the low doping, it's a very good metal, as showed by Ando's work. I think I'm pretty sure about that part. Okay. And another thing is that, you know, when you, the charging is such a random thing. Okay, when I show you this data, it's just there's a bond, always, it never goes through that. I mean, So, I mean, there was a substantial statistics in the measurement. Yes, please.
Seeing a sigma of omega, you can do very fast at spur, and you have twice full on energy, and you look at the activation energy, and if you see the stiffity, you see half of energy.
Yeah, but it should
show up. I mean, I've had people running around for years saying, you know, based on these transportation measurements at very low doping, you're dealing with sort of full on vision. This is new. I mean, it's all very much listened to.
But is that
really the
sample? I mean, that's genetic statement. My question is more specific.
You know, in 204. And 204 is supposed to be
the same problem.
Yeah.
Well, but the 214 looks very similar. Yeah. I mean, yeah, very similar. I mean, you know, this the transport, how to interpret transport, as Young said, there are many different ways.
Really, you know, people are making noise about the classic signature support for the transport. It's only in the 214.
Okay, Young, you're right.
Right, there's some logical reasons. Let's go over that.
Ah, yes, Masa. Yes, I have data. We have a lot of data from this system. It's a very interesting, and that connects to what Seamus Davis has. But I did not prepare for that. Basically, this was a discussion in the morning, and we decided this will be a more appropriate topic, so I changed the talk completely. So I don't have that, but I'll be happy to show you. But those were in pretty highly doped systems, in BISCO and in relatively highly doped systems.
Yeah, but what happens in the superconducting state, in the underdoping?
Yeah, as I said, for those material or for other material. You see, the issue is that BISCO really there's not a whole lot of very good data below 10% doping. Okay, and I will question anyone make a lot of statement below 10% doping for BISCO, unless that's an yttrium-doped BISCO. Okay, so we don't have a whole lot of data on BISCO in that sense. And on the other hand, those materials, because their TC is so low, technically make it very difficult for us to make a detailed measurement below TC. Because there's a limit of how low the temperature we can go in that experiment.
But that could have some underlying similarity, right?
Yeah, it could have, but there's a difference whether I can tell you there is or not. Okay. But I do want to say that at the antinodal region, okay, we see if you do an MDC analysis, a Fermi surface, which is extremely nested with a periodicity very close to 4A, okay, but the spectra, even in 12% doped, is extremely broad, just like manganese or any of the boron systems. Okay, so. So I think you probably hear a lot about what I talk about, the phonons and the dynamics and all that. I think it will be a good thing for me, at least since we are talking about some related subject. But I want to point it out to you that what I'm going to tell you now are the results at optimum or overdoped, highly doped situation. It's somewhat different. Okay? But there is, in my view, ultimately a coherent connection between them. I want to talk about the strong momentum and the temperature. A priori, we know that the lattice thing for a long time, we think they should be independent of momentum, independent of temperature. That's sort of the perception, okay? The general perception, and should be in same in the normal and a superconducting state. And we now feel there are evidence that's not the case. And they also feel that the lambda should be independent of frequency. That's not the case too. This is a subject you'll probably hear me talk about it. And basically is that the good thing about angle resolved photo meshing is that I have a dispersion. Then I can, if the electrons not coupled to any collective mode because the band is very broad, if you take a small energy window, it's basically more or less a straight line or slightly, but it's a smooth curve. Okay, a coupling to a collective mode will give you a sharp structure. That's one way. Maybe Doug, there are other ways to get this thing, maybe, but I want to look at that. And of course, this is another. That's our own data. About 10 years ago, that was the thesis of Dan Bessel, and you see a dispersion, and you fit it with the tie binding at that time, okay? And now we see a kink in the dispersion here, okay? And that is the thing we've been discussing and thinking a lot, and that's the kink we've been talking about, and that's there, even in the lower limit image plot, you don't need. And you can see that that again is a progress with the angular resolution. I mean, we would never have seen that in our earlier data. Okay. This has been, there's a lot of discussion and in debate. And we say, because it happens in all materials, take this, basically there's a break here. It happens at all materials, and it's a fairly universal feature, and we say this is due to the coupling to a phonon. The red is arrow I thought about earlier, say it was the breathing phonon in this problem, and has the frequency. Red is the indication of neutron scattering experiment showing anomalous behavior at this frequency. That's one view. Okay, that's the reason we based on that. Then there's alternative view saying this, I believe, was seen in several groups of data, including that of argon and Brookhaven. But the paper who really stressed this point was the paper by Dan Dessau. That's the majority view. And okay, the majority view was that you see these effects. That's the data taken at the node, and this is the data taken at the antinode, okay? And said, look, there's very little effect. The normal state dispersion was pretty straight, okay? right? Once you go to the superconducting state, you see a sharp you see a kink. Therefore, it was a temperature-induced kink, and they also, we all agree, it's an indication of an electron interacting with a collective mode. It's just what particular collective mode was way based on the universal property of different materials, say it was phonons, and all other groups, we are minority, okay, all other groups say that it was the spin fluctuation. I think the most strong argument were two. One is say it was the temperature dependence, okay, and the other was saying it happens at the antinode, strongest, and the consistent with pi-pi scattering, and was always attributed to the pi-pi spin resonance. Okay. And we always felt the spin resonance has a problem because there are so many materials, similar phenomenon being observed, the resonance was not even there, and we can talk about doping and various things. So the question always for, I think correctly, in any field of debate of science, I think it's extremely healthy because we have a very different views to look at this problem. In any, the basic is to say that, okay, on the one hand, people want to take the point of view, I have a spin resonance to explain this phenomenon, and they want to push to see how far they can go. Okay? On the other hand, I said, well, this maybe look like a phonons, and I want to see how far I can go. Okay. Now, what I want to show to you is to see how far we can go. Okay. Now, as I said, the burden for me to prove that can this picture understand the temperature and momentum dependence, which was the stronghold of the other view. The burden for them to prove that can you show this effect in materials where the resonance mode does not exist, or in deeply overdoped system does not exist, or in magnetic field where we know this resonance mode was completely washed, this effect was in optics was not there.
Effect here that can be very, very easily verified if that's the thing.
My former postdoc, Alessandra Lanzala, she's trying the isotope effect. She has done that, and she has her own career, and she's doing that experiment. I'm not involved in that. Okay. Okay. So what happened now is that we improved the signal to noise, okay? And we find that what is interesting, I show you, what is, yeah, let me just skip this for one moment and show you what this phenomenology is, so that this is the results known for a long time. It's basically, you can see a dispersion of this system as you go towards the antinode. It's almost like a break into two branches. So one branch does this, and another branch does this. That's what we call branch one and branch two. If I would have tracking this peak, they do this. If I tracking this peak, they do that. I can also analyze the data by making scans in K space and track out the peak position. And that is this guy, okay? So you can see the kink position corresponding to the asymptotic frequency of this guy. Okay. So that's the basic phenomenology of that, okay? That's the traditional way you plot it. You can see two structures, one and two. Okay, now let me just come back. Used to say that this effect is only seen in the superconducting state, but I think now what we say is that actually when you improve the data, even in the normal state at optimum doping, okay, even in the normal state at optimum doping, you see weaker but observable effect. And that's the top panel is the three independent data set, which suggesting something happened around the 40 millivolt in the normal state. Some anomaly happened in the 40 millivolt in the normal state. But the observation of a existence but a weaker effect is important. And of course, as you go below TC, this being shifted, okay, and the effect gets much stronger. Okay. That's the basic observables. How I will tie this together? Now, I think this shows a striking momentum dependence. Okay. You can see that at the node region, if I make a cut, you see a small kink in the dispersion. Those are all raw data without an analysis. Okay, you see a kink. This kink, as you go towards the antenna, this kink gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, if you make that cut, you can see the kink, and this kink gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and extremely strong, so strong that basically the band being cut off all by itself. Okay, I think all the sides on the debate, sort of, at least this side of the debate, say, well, this is some strong coupling effect, seeing that. Okay, and now I want to say that I also show a little bit of a doping dependence. I want to say we now identify this to be this lower frequency one to be the bond buckling phonon, which has this shape. I think something Doug considered 8 years ago. This basically to say that it has a out-of-plane, out-of-phase oxygen motion. Okay, that's the bond buckling phonon. Now, we try to tie our experiment to other experiment in the zeros order. We know in cuprates, there were two phonons being observed by neutron scattering has a peculiar effect. One is the breathing mode, and the one is this buckling mode. Okay. There could be others. They haven't been found, but this at least being shown. Okay. Now, this one is known to show softening only at the high Q. Okay. And this one is showing softening only at the low Q. Early on, we were focusing on this because it softens the high Q, then it's natural they like to connect the node region because that's connected by high Q. But now we think they were important for this Q. Now, yeah.
Same kind of thing, softening in dual-four, maybe
LTT type phase. Yeah, the I think the LTT also involves some out-of-plane oxygen motion. So I think that's called the BZ mode.
Okay,
yeah, I think they probably somehow there's a linear superposition relationship with that. Okay. So this is the work by Tom Devereaux. Well, basically what it boiled down to that we sent, one of the referees raised a very good question, was saying that to explain your data, you need a lambda, which is huge. Okay? I think in our paper we quoted that we cannot decide decisively, but it's somewhere between 1 to 3. That's a very large coupling, very large number. The referee said, well, people have analyzed Raman scattering data from the same materials and get a lambda from 0.1 to 0.2, right? And you can't have a discrepancy by a factor of 10, because especially lambda, if you take it seriously, eventually come in exponentially, right, in the problem of inches. So it was a good question. Then the burden is for me to say that. And the good thing about it is that it was shown who the person who did the Raman scattering. That's Tom Devereaux. So I went to Tom and I said, is that possible? There's a momentum dependence which was not considered that. And he was very open-minded. He said, I'll go back and look at it. Okay, that was a similar code he did. Those calculations are not fancy. I mean, you know, I wanted to go to high doping where some sort of quasi-particle picture can be applicable. So what he did was he analyzed the electron phonon vertex And I find that this is for the buckling mode, okay, it's just one of the two considered. What I find is that a vertex is strongly, because of the symmetry of the phonon involved, is strongly dependent on the initial state, k. You can see you have a k here, okay. Of course, you have very little coupling nearby because this phonon happens to have a d-wave like behavior, that's why, okay. And then, but if you put the vertex at anti-node, you can see a very strong coupling effect. Okay? And the largest coupling, indeed, was the coupling of scattering across this parallel Fermi surface. Indeed, they were dominated by small q scattering. If you do that, at least within this theory, you can see that if you would use the average lambda, which is seen by Raman, is the movement, is the Brillouin zone space lambda, about 0.2, okay, at the anti-node you can have 2 to 3, which says that those these two are not necessarily incompatible. This is quite striking. Okay, so the angular, the momentum dependence, there is a possible way to explain. Now I want to say something about temperature dependence. Very often you have people say, well, you have a dramatic effect in the below TC, you don't have the effect in the normal state. Therefore this effect can only be the mode created below TC coupling. I want to point out to you that two things. That's the data, the normal and the superconducting state. Okay. Now, this complicated line shape was taken as a sort of consequence of the mode coupling effect, with the mode at roughly at this frequency. Okay. Of course, if you really look at this data, you say, ah, of course, you see this effect, you basically don't see anything in the normal state. Okay. But I want to point out that usually when you do that, you're comparing normal state taking at 100K or 110K. Because this is the high TC material, you can't have excess of normal state at a low temperature. Okay. In order to go to normal state, you have to go to a very high temperature. Okay. So here's the, these are not fancy theory. I think Anderson and Doug actually did it earlier. Okay. And we'll just say that if I were to do a normal state calculation at a zero frequency, then of course a collective mode is show me I have a step-like function below the phonon frequency because of scattering, like zero frequency. But now if I would, zero temperature, if I would allow a normal state but a broadened to a finite temperature, you see what happens is that when you have a boson coupled to a fermion system, right, the Fermi function gets imprinted to the boson if there's a thermal broadening. This thermal broadening is about 4.4 kT. At 110 Kelvin, that's where typically data is taken, that will give you 50 millivolt broadening, 4.4 kT at 100 K. But when you go to a superconducting state, we know that because you have a, not only you have low temperature, you also have a very almost singular-like behavior in the density states piled up, and that gives you enhancement. And that, so Tom has taken into account both the modes, one's the buckling mode and one's the breathing mode. It turns out below TC, the buckling mode dominates it. Okay, in this case, and measure it at different location. You can see that that's the normal and superconducting state data, and that's the calculation. Of course, you can see the discrepancy. There's a lot of additional broadening. But this essence of this sharp collective mode thing, this actually catches a lot of the essence of that. Okay, and the anisotropy is in particular, here we are making two cuts, both in theory and experiment, which are 10% away from each other in the Brillouin zone. And you see both theory and experiment shows a quite a large difference. Of course, you can see that the experiment have a lot more additional broadening, okay, in. Okay. But the sharp structure seemed to be catched on that. Therefore, I think I would say now is that I think there's a similar level of interpretation for both the momentum and the temperature dependence of the data as that of the spin mode. So this, in other words, this debate going on, this debate continues, and I will say that now the burden was more on the spin mode to explain the following things. Why in materials you don't see it? Why in deeply overdoped material where there's neither observed nor expected? Why you don't see them change with the magnetic field? Why the mode broadens so much as you go under doping? Well, this effect gets stronger and sharper. And when you go to the detail and you see the hotspot. So anyway, I think the sport of this debate remained to be very, very good. And I thank you for your patience. Yes, please.
I'll ask the same question I had before. So in the cohort of region, if you have this harm electron point scattering,
yeah,
as you believe,
is that consistent with the transport?
Yeah, it should, because in semiconductor subject I know a lot about. In gallium arsenide, for example,
yeah,
you know, the photon modes are known.
Yeah.
And one time there can be 20% kind of agreement between experiment and theory, but a very broad temperature range, 1 Kelvin to, you know, 500 Kelvin. And that should happen.
Yeah, I would say two things. I mean, number one is that I'm not saying these are the only effect. Okay, there's no reason to believe. There was a whole section of this talk, which I cut it out because I want to talk about chemical potential. Okay, B is that those phonon frequencies for the buckling mode was so high in frequency, 70 millivolts, that's 700 Kelvin. For the breathing mode, it has very little to do with the node, which governs the transport property. So I don't think you can, based on that, argue that's inconsistent.
Is there any serious attempt to look into the transport
contribution of compound? I'm not aware of that, and I think it was just starting in the early stage, and you know, again, I mean, it's not. I don't think I was paid to do all that, and somebody else wanted to do that. They want to do that. Okay, yeah, yeah, Jason.
I continue the question. I understand that you don't want to pursue too much about the isotope effect, but since you have an estimate of lambda, so what's your estimate for the percentage change?
Okay. The isotope effect, of course, traditionally we know it shifts the frequency. We don't know what it will do to other things. Shift frequency is about 5%. It's about 4 millivolt. It's very hard to say beyond the statistical significance.
So it's a visible change in the cross-particle spectrum?
Some of you probably heard from Alessandra, she does saw changes. But as I said, I mean, she has her own career, and I think it's better for her to talk about that. Yes?
Suppose the node is
very
and if that is the case, do you have anything to say about the mechanism,
supercomputing
from that
node? I think Doug probably has a better answer better than me, and we have so far mostly concentrated on can we at least use photoemission, make this to understand the photoemission data. And Doug has considered this more than probably I have. So that'll be it. So I think, but if this mode, especially the breathing mode, is important, actually, I think it will do something. And I'll be very surprised if the understanding of photoemission turned out to be correct. And it acts so strongly at the region where it matters in momentum space. It will do nothing. I think it will be very surprising to me. It may do bad things, but it will do something.
All right, I've stopped enough for the class. You guys see everything else?